This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Hello, you're about to listen to Series 2 of Lady Killers. New episodes will be released weekly. But if you're in the UK and you can't wait, you can hear it all right now, before anywhere else. First, on BBC Sounds. Welcome to a new series of Lady Killers from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Imagine you're a woman born into slavery in 19th century America. Then imagine you have children of your own. But these children aren't really your own because they belong to the man who owns you.
Anyone she knew, let alone loved, who hadn't run off or been hanged, got rented out, loaned out, bought up, brought back, stored up, mortgaged, won, stolen, or seized. The shock was learning that nobody stopped playing checkers just because the pieces included her children. Her two girls, neither of whom had their adult teeth, were sold and gone, and she had not been able to wave goodbye.
These chilling words are spoken by an enslaved mother in Toni Morrison's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Beloved. It was inspired by the real-life story of Margaret Garner, an enslaved woman. When Margaret Garner was asked the question, "Is slavery a fate worse than death?" she had a horrifying answer. I'm Lucy Worsley, and I'm joined by a crack team of investigators to take a look, a feminist look actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes committed by lady killers in Britain, North America, and Australia. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask, what drove these ordinary women to do these extraordinary things? What do these lady killers tell us about the world they lived in and about women's lives in the past? And what might they tell us about our own lives today? It's the winter of 1856 in Kentucky, in the southern part of the USA. And Margaret Garner, a 22-year-old enslaved woman, is about to commit a murder. She's also about to transform herself into an icon of tragedy and resistance. Margaret already has four small children, and she's pregnant with the fifth. She and her children are owned by a man called Archibald K. Gaines of Richwood in Boone County. Margaret's husband Robert and his parents are enslaved on a farm several miles away, and they're owned by the Marshall family. In the 1850s, that's the decade before the Civil War, the United States of America consists of 15 slave states and 16 free states. Although the movement in the North to abolish slavery is gaining strength, enslaved people like Margaret and her family in the South see little hope of freedom. To explore Margaret Garner's remarkable story, I'm joined by Nikki M. Taylor, Professor of African American History at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and the author of a remarkable book, Driven Towards Madness, The Fugitive Slave, Margaret Garner, and Tragedy on the Ohio. Nikki, welcome to Lady Killers.
Thank you. What an honour to be here.
We know that slavery destroys bodies and minds, but it also destroys families too. Can I ask you about this marriage between Margaret and her husband, Robert? They were living in different places, working for different owners. Was that typical of marriage between enslaved people at the time?
Unfortunately, it was. She rarely ever saw her husband. The children rarely ever saw their father. It meant that she had very little help in the rearing and the guiding of her children from her husband. Real life breathing families were destroyed by slavery.
That extract from Beloved we heard about children being taken from their mother and sold, that chilled me to the bone. Is there a sense, Nikki, that enslaved women were kind of treated like livestock as providers of children to become new parts of the labor force?
The number one way after the ending of the slave trade in the U.S., the number one way to increase one's enslaved population was through reproduction. And so this, at the center of that was how often enslaved women reproduced. These white enslavers build their wealth on the backs and on the wombs of these enslaved women.
This is so dark and difficult to think about. Can I ask you, Nikki, what kind of work Margaret did for the Gaines family on this farm?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, the answer is simple: everything. So she worked inside the house, she cooked, she cleaned for the Gaines family and for her own children. But she also had to tend to the crops and the fields and the animals. She worked perpetually around the clock for that family, but also for her own. She had four children under the age of 8 years old. And so her work was incessant. None of us can really wrap our mind around that kind of service and servitude and what that does to the soul and to the body.
Boone County in Kentucky, where the Garners are enslaved, is a tantalizing 16 miles from Cincinnati, across the Ohio River in the free state of Ohio. Margaret's husband, Robert, and her in-laws, his parents, have glimpsed freedom because they've actually run errands to Cincinnati for their owners, and they've made contact with relatives living there. But their chances of running away and getting to Cincinnati are vanishingly small. Even so, the Garners decide it is worth risking their lives and the lives of their children for the chance of freedom. On the night of the 27th of January, 1856, the temperature is close to minus 20 degrees Celsius. Margaret's husband, Robert, waits for his owners to go to bed. Then he takes an old sleigh and horses from the Marshall farm and he leaves. He and his parents arrive to pick up Margaret and the children at their farm at 10 p.m. The journey to the river takes all night. They avoid the toll roads, which are patrolled, and the sleigh travels over farmland and on tracks. They finally abandon the exhausted horses near the banks of the Ohio River, which at this time of year is frozen over. Now they face the most dangerous part of their escape. The riverbank is closely monitored by police watchmen looking out for fugitive slaves. And they're not sure if the ice will bear their weight. Goodness, what risks they're taking here, Nikki. I suppose that's a sign of desperation.
You know, the Ohio River was the biggest obstacle for enslaved people in that region of the country, the biggest obstacle and barrier to freedom. We can hardly imagine the Ohio River freezing today. Before climate change, it froze all the time, especially in January. That's what this family figured out. It was just easier to be able to use the Ohio River as a footbridge. And so instead of a barrier to freedom, it became a conduit to freedom if they left in the winter.
Did people often go with their families or did they prefer to travel alone?
Most of the time, the runaways tended to be young, single men. So it was very unusual for an intact family, three generations of one family, to go together at the same time. I can't think of another example. in American history.
Now, nearly miraculously, all eight members of the family do get across the ice to Cincinnati. They carry the children, and by early morning, they reach the house of their relatives, the Kite family. From here, they hope to get the help of members of the Underground Railroad, a secret network who pass people who've escaped slavery from one place of safety to the next. I asked Novella Nemo at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in downtown Cincinnati to describe what that city was like when the Garners arrived there in 1856.
So looking across at downtown Cincinnati, we have all of these high skyscrapers, the high rises, the condos, the apartments. You really have to have a lot of money to live downtown Cincinnati. But back then, it was almost like it was the worst area in Cincinnati to live. And that's where they put the African-American community. And nobody else wanted to live on the river. Where the African-American community was, you had the killing of pigs. So you had the smell. I'm sure you had a lot of rats. There was a lot of racial tension here in Cincinnati during that time because you had a lot of people that profit off of slavery. Living in Cincinnati area was a very, very dangerous area for the African-American community. So Cincinnati tries to honor the past, and they're just coming to terms with it. I would say there could be a lot of people that think that what happened back in the 1800s was okay. There are still a lot of people in Kentucky that believe that what they did was right. But how can you move on when the injustices is still affecting the African American community? America has a lot to come to grips with. And to say, okay, we did this. How can we make it better? Instead of saying, we don't want to talk about it. It's history, but it's our history. It's not just Black history, it's America's history.
For the Garner family, any feelings of freedom and safety having reached the Kite House are horribly brief. A story that starts with courage and hope is to end only hours later with tragedy. Margaret and her family are quickly missed by their owners. It's not hard to follow sleigh tracks in the snow. And within a few hours, Archibald Gaines and Thomas Marshall are outside the Kite House, furious. And they have a written warrant, gained under the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, for the return of their human property. The house is surrounded by people sympathetic to the slave owners. They're kind of self-appointed marshals, and a large crowd gathers. The Garners refuse to come out. The marshals force an entry. In the confusion, Margaret's husband fires a pistol, injuring a deputy. Margaret knows that capture is now inevitable. She takes a butcher's knife from the counter in the kitchen. She picks up her two-year-old daughter, Mary, and cuts her throat with one stroke, declaring, "Before my children shall be taken back to Kentucky, I will kill every one of them." There's a violent struggle with the people who've come to take her, and the knife is wrested away from Margaret. But before she's taken, she picks up a heavy coal shovel and she tries to kill her baby Scylla as well. The Garners are taken to jail. Two clergymen, the Reverend Bassett and the Reverend Bushnell, visit Margaret. They find her with baby Scylla in her arms, bearing a scar from the shovel. Margaret is clear-headed and unrepentant.
"I was as cool as I am now. If I'd had more time, I would have killed them all. I would much rather kill them at once and thus end their sufferings than have them taken back to slavery and be murdered by piecemeal. Now little Mary is free from all trouble and sorrow. She was my own, given me of God to do the best a mother could. I did the best I could. I knew it was better for them to go home to God than back to slavery. The days of suffering the nights of unmitigated toil. Slavery is more cruel than death.
Those were Margaret's words, Nikki, as they were reported by the clergyman who visited her in prison. Is that as close as we're going to get, do you think, to her words, her state of mind at this time?
That's as close as we'll get. So it just underlines and underscores what's happened to the archive as it relates to recording and preserving the words and records of Black women, especially enslaved Black women.
How do you, in your work as a historian, go about overcoming that challenge?
Well, the first thing is you have to believe that the story can be told. And so you have to persist, and you have to think outside the box in order to be able to get at the voices and the intentions. And so I'm very grateful to have those words, those actual words of enslaved Black women. It is very important to me as a Black woman, as a descendant of enslaved Black women, it is important for me to reclaim these women's voices.
So, Nikki, I think it's fairly obvious that part of the legacy of all of this is that African-American women's voices more generally in modern society are less often heard, wouldn't you say?
That's absolutely correct. And the reason for that is that, unfortunately, we reside at the intersections of several different oppressed groups. So we are women, we tend to be poor, and we're also African Americans. And so as a result, we have to work harder to make our voices heard and to amplify our voices, not just in the political sphere, but even in our everyday lives, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, in our communities.
Now, Nikki, once Margaret is in jail, a huge amount of legal wrangling starts up because the state law and the federal law are actually in conflict. Can you explain?
Yes, the federal law that is governing this case is the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law. And that law basically suspended a lot of her potential rights that she would have had, including the right to a writ of habeas corpus, the right to a jury trial, even the right to an attorney and things like that.
So her owner, Archibald Gaines, his view is, don't put her on trial for murder because, first and foremost, she's a fugitive slave. And does he see it in his terms that she's a thief, foremost, because she has stolen five valuable items of property, which are herself and her four children? Well, six, I suppose, if you include her unborn child. Is that what her owner would have been thinking?
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it, Lucy. But at the very least, he just thought it was an inconvenience that he had to even be in court because by custom, you could just go reclaim your enslaved person, just like somebody could go reclaim a horse if it escaped onto your neighbor's property. You could just go get your horse back. And then the anti-slavery forces in Cincinnati and beyond said, no, she should be tried as, somebody who has committed murder under Ohio law. And the logic of that is that she would be convicted for murder, and then she would serve a couple of years in jail and then would ultimately be freed on Ohio soil. So it's not that the anti-slavery people didn't think that she shouldn't pay for her crime. They just knew that after that, she would be free.
I guess she was difficult for the anti-slavery people to deal with because there's this kind of extra level of condemnation attached to mothers who kill their children, do you think?
Exactly. Yeah, of course. Nobody wants to hear about a story in which a child is damaged or killed. Now, people do want to hear about enslaved women's resistance in other ways, but not in this way.
Enter Lucy Stone, a white campaigner against slavery and a campaigner for women's rights. She visits Margaret in jail. She says to Margaret that 1,000 hearts are aching for her and they are glad one child of hers is safe with the angels. Then when testifying in court about her meeting with Margaret, Lucy Stone drops a bombshell.
The faded faces of the Negro children tell too plainly to what degradation female slaves submit. Rather than give her little daughter to that life, she killed it. If, in her deep maternal loves, she felt the impulse to send her child back to God to save it from coming woe, who shall say she had no right to do so? How then could I blame her for wishing her child to find freedom with God and the angels, where no chains are?
This is dynamite. Lucy Stone is laying bare the most controversial aspect of the case. She's saying that Margaret's light-skinned daughters are not the children of Margaret's husband, but of her owner, Mr. Gaines. He believes that he owns Margaret's body and that he can do what he likes with it. Enslaved women are sexually enslaved too. According to Kentucky law, only white women can be raped. If an enslaved woman is raped by someone other than her owner, it isn't rape, it's trespass. Goodness, so do you think, Nikki, that it's sexual abuse of this nature, being raped by the master, that she's trying to save her daughters from?
Exactly. In the 19th century, in America, because of Victorian notions, it wasn't proper for any woman, black or white, to explicitly talk about sexual assault. That's why what Lucy Stone did was so extraordinary, because she said it so explicitly, but it was very much considered not feminine to explicitly level these charges. But Lucy Stone did it.
Do you think, Nikki, as women who aren't enslaved, we can have any comprehension of the sort of brutality of living in that state, which it doesn't excuse, but it sort of explains Margaret's actions?
I don't think so. As oppressive as I think my life may be in certain areas, my daughter would never be sexually vulnerable to my employer, his sons, his friends, his cousins, his uncles, every person who comes onto his land. And I have the ability to protect her in her childhood from all hurts and traumas. She had none of that. And so we cannot really put ourselves in her shoes. And although 22, she had enough of a vision for what she wanted for herself and her children that she says, I may not know much about freedom, but I know it has to be better than this.
Margaret Garner's story resonates powerfully with Novella Nemo back at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. She works to keep alive the memory of enslaved people. And Novella also helps to run a project campaigning to end slavery around the world today.
We do not know, but we believe anywhere from 21 million to 45 million people are enslaved today. And a lot of it is prostitution, sex trafficking, child labor, domestic servitude, and all of that. But majority of it is sex trafficking. So one of the biggest areas for sex trafficking is in America, but it's so invisible that it's right there in front of us. In Slavery Now Project is about putting the information out there so people can understand and know what to look for. We want to be a beacon of light to bring people to a point where it touches their heart. So that they can go out and be abolitionists today. And that's what we need. We have a balcony that has an eternal flame. And that eternal flame will burn until the last person in the world is free. And unfortunately, at this time, we believe that flame will never go out because we don't see enslavement being extinguished because it's so invisible.
That's interesting. Isn't it? I mean, it's really tempting for us alive today to think, oh, we're better than these people in the 19th century. What do you think about that, Nikki?
today. In the U.S., I'm only going to speak for my own country, Black and brown women, Black and Latino women, African immigrant women are also being trafficked and being compelled to work in labor camps and fields, picking tomatoes and things like that, are being threatened and having their property stolen from them. And so this is still happening. And so it's really horrific that our society has not evolved enough to figure out how to eradicate slavery. There's no place for it. There should be no stomach for it, no tolerance for it. But here we are.
Margaret's murder of her daughter happened in 1856, and slavery was finally abolished 9 years later in the US in 1865. Nikki, how much did Margaret Garner's story change things? Did it change public attitudes and debates on slavery at all?
It definitely changed the debates, especially about the fugitive slave law. And it definitely changed the debates about inserting women's rights into the slave question. Another final thing I want to say is that Margaret Garner's case brought to attention this stereotype, an age-old stereotype of the angry Black and often violent Black woman. That this is one of the first instances of this stereotype of the angry Black woman that has long haunted African Americans. How do you demonize a woman that simply wanted freedom for her children? And you demonize her to such a way that, you know, she's almost presented as a demon or a devil in the media.
Now, I'm sorry to tell you that there is still more tragedy to come in Margaret's story. The Garners are returned to their owners, and then they're sold to new owners further south. And while Margaret and her baby are travelling there, down to New Orleans, she's travelling in a steamer, the steamer sinks, and the baby drowns. Margaret dies just 2 years later of typhoid fever at the age of 25. The lives of the rest of her family, like the lives of most enslaved people, are lost to history. But I'm so glad we know Margaret's story, because through her desperate actions, she changed the debate about slavery and about women's rights too. And her life resonates so powerfully today when women, especially women of colour, are still struggling to free themselves from oppression and to get their voices heard. Nikki, one final question from me. How do you think we should remember Margaret Garner?
When I wrote about Margaret Garner, my own daughter was in college. And I thought about how pregnant her life was with possibilities. And I thought about how her boundless opportunities and freedom and how many things she dreamed and envisioned for herself. And I said, this is all that Margaret wanted for her girls. That's it. That's what she wanted. Is that too much to ask? I think not. And she says, if she can't have that, then there'll be nothing at all.
Well, a huge thank you to Professor Nikki Taylor and to Novella Nemo in Cincinnati. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to Melbourne, Australia, to investigate a backstreet abortionist who spent decades playing cat and mouse with the law. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Moya Angela and Laurel Lefko. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying Lady Killers, we have a brand new episode every week. But if you can't wait, you'll find the full series available right now on BBC Sounds.
Oh, another thunderstorm.
Lights out.
Sometimes I just can't hear difference between thunder or shelling or explosions.
documentary adventures that invite a closer listen.
We were willing to put not only our bodies on the line, but our whole being.
A documentary podcast from BBC Radio 4.
Right. So do you mind...
Testing?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, what did you have for a purpose today?
I'm here to talk about a traumatic experience.
What did you have for a breakfast?
I had pancakes.
Subscribe to Lights Out on BBC Sounds.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns. Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.